Well, first, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present my work here. It's a pleasure to be here and in Toronto. So before I start the presentation, maybe I should maybe justify the choice of the subject matter to you and maybe to my employer as well. Why am I even bothering about stochastic volatility models? Well, it so happens that an exotic option is something that by definition is not replicable by a static position in vanilla options. So that means that as you risk manage a book of exotics, you're going to do a dynamic trading in vanilla options. And by doing that, you become sensitive to the realized dynamics of implied volatilities. So it would be very natural to try and write at an ab initio dynamics on the implied volatilities themselves, and this is something that has been tried by several people. Maybe some of you remember the paper by Philippe Schönbucher on this subject, and you, those who have read the paper, probably know that it's a very hard thing to do because the constraints of no arbitrage on the dynamics of implied volatilities of vanilla options are very hard to satisfy. A much more general way of doing the same thing is what was presented this morning by Lane Houston, i.e. modeling the dynamics of the density. Now, obviously you want to have a handle on the dynamics of the implied volatilities of the vanilla options, and so that's why you would want to write a dynamic directly on the implied volatilities of vanilla options. But maybe those are not the right instruments to start with if you're trying to do something easy. You can try and model the dynamics of implied volatilities of other instruments. And for example, instead of vanilla options, choose the log of S profile. That's a convex payoff minus log. It has an implied volatility, and maybe it's easier to model the dynamics of that thing. And that's exactly what stochastic volatility models do. So the starting point for the material of this presentation was a very natural question from a practitioner point of view, which is the following. Let's say you start with a stochastic volatility model. This model is going to do two things for you that come in a package that are inseparable. One thing is that the stochastic vol model will produce a smile. Fine. So that's something static. That's a static picture of the model. You have the model, please give me the implied volatilities for all strikes and expiries, it does that. The other thing it does, which is why I like to use stochastic volatility models, and I'm not the only one, is that it generates a dynamics for implied volatilities. That's why you want to use the model for. And so the question is there a relationship between these two aspects of the model? So one is a static feature, the other is a dynamic feature. Stated differently, imagine I'm a practitioner and I have a given smile and I'm trying to fit a stochastic vol model on that smile. I can ask the question, okay, maybe I can find a different stochastic vol model that will give the same smile but a different dynamics for implied volatilities. So in other words, how much freedom am I allowed in the choice for the dynamics of implied volatilities when I'm constrained to a given smile? And especially if there's a connection between the two. So if there's a strong connection between the two aspects, static and dynamic, I have the answer to my question. The question is, I have very little freedom. If not, then I have a lot of freedom. So how structural is the nature of this connection? So that's what we're going to look at here, and very generally, we're not going to assume any specific model except that it be a diffuse stochastic volatility model. So we'll see that to do that, there's a natural notion that we introduce, which is the skew stickiness ratio. And that will come in the characterization of the connection. And once we have the connection between the static and the dynamic aspect, we can look at what that implies for long maturity smiles. And we'll see that actually we get as a bonus an expression that links the decay of the at-the-money skew with this skew stickiness ratio. And he also tells us something about short maturity smiles. And then we're going to look at what happens in reality in market smiles. Do they even behave like what a stochastic volatility model would want them to behave like. So actually, all of the material in this presentation was published in a paper in Risk Magazine in 2009. And I know that academics do not read Risk Magazine, are not subscribers, so I've posted all of the papers on the SSRN website. So there's the four papers. And it's the last one that contains the material that I'm going to present now. Okay, so what are the objects we're going to work with? Well, the easiest objects to work with in a stochastic volatility model are forward variances. So imagine you have variance swap quotes for different maturities. In practice, they exist for discrete maturities, maybe a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year, etc. But you can imagine you have them for continuous maturities. You're going to interpolate. And so you have this volatility sigma t capital T. So small t is the time and capital T is the maturity. It's a date, a given date. So you can define this forward variances xi, which actually you can trade. I mean, not the continuous versions of xi, but the discrete ones. And because you can trade them using variance swaps, these things have no drift. They are driftless. And so the general expression I will use for a stochastic volatility model, what I call a stochastic volatility model, is this one. So these things have no drift. They are driven, let's say, by Brownian motion, maybe by a Brownian sheet. There's a Brownian motion for each capital T. There's something here, like a volatility of volatility. And then the connection with the dynamics for the spot process is here, which is that the instantaneous variance of the spot process is the short end of the variance curve. It's xi evaluated for capital T equals small t. So you may be used to standard stochastic volatility models like the Hessian model, which are written in terms of this instantaneous variance V, which is xi evaluated at capital T equals small t. And Vt is an animal that man has never seen. But anyway, this is what it is. And when you look at the drift of V starting from this kind of specification, you get a drift. Unlike forward variances, that has a drift. And what the drift of the instantaneous variance is exactly the slope of the short end of the variance curve. Anyway, because they are driftless, forward variances are more convenient objects to work with. So what we're going to do, actually, is first look at the static picture of the model and we'll focus on just the Edmonis Q and its dependence on maturity. And we'll be doing all of the calculations at order one in volatility of volatility. So I'm going to show right away what I mean by that. Sorry. Yes, exactly. Yeah, can be anything, yeah. Actually, we won't even need to specify how many they are. Yeah, exactly. Generally, could be driven by a Brownian sheet. So I'm going to use this kind of specification. I do not want you to pay too much attention to what's written up there, because actually I won't be using it really. It's just so. But what's important is that omega factor. So the dynamics for the spot process is the standard one, and then if you look at the dynamics for the forward variances. You see that there's omega, then xi, and then these lambdas, these are functions of the whole curve. That's why it's lambda of xi and there's no capital T. They could be functions of the whole variance curve and driven by some number of Brownian motions. Fine. So what I'm assuming here is that it's really a stochastic volatility model in the sense that there's no local volatility component. And what this omega allows me to do, it's switch on and off the volatility of volatility. If omega is zero, the xi are frozen. They have the values they have at t equals zero, and so I have a Black-Scholes model. As I turn omega on, I get volatility of volatility. And we will be working at order one in omega. That's what I mean by order one in volatility of volatility. So we're going to compute the Edmonis Q at order one in omega. So you see that in the spot dynamics, the only thing that enters is xi for capital T equals small t. So if we look at it, it has a very simple expression, and I'm expanding at order 1 in omega. So whenever the quantities have a substrate 0, it means they are evaluated in what I call the unperturbed state, which is when there's no volatility of volatility. So anyway, so we get this little perturbation that's linear in omega, and now we're going to compute the Eddemoni forward skew. So one straight way of doing it would be to just write the pricing equation, expand at order the pricing PD, expand at order 1 in omega, do the computation, and then imply the volatility, the implied volatility, and get the skew. Now there's another way of getting exactly the same result. It's exactly the same, you can check it, which is just to use this approximation for the skew. Now, when you look at the distribution of log of S, capital T, so here I divide by the forward, but doesn't really matter. And if you assume that distribution of X is slightly non-Gaussian, smooth but slightly non-Gaussian, so the third order cumulant is not zero but it's small, then you have this very nice identity between the skew and the skewness of X. So what I call the skew is d sigma over d log k taken at the forward, and the skewness, small s, is really the skewness of this random variable x. So it's a dimensionless number, which is third order cumulant divided by second order cumulant to the 3/2. And there's this connection that says that the skew is approximately the skewness divided by 6 square root of capital T. So let's compute this skewness at order 1 in omega. So these cumulants have this form, and here I see that I've kept a bad habit from physics. The graph is just the expectation, actually. But anyway. So we have the expression there for S, so we have d log S. We just expand at order 1 in omega, and we have this expression here. So this is what you would get if there were no volatility of volatility. So psi substrate 0 is the variance curve that's observed at t equals 0, and this is the perturbation at order 1 in omega. So for the sake of computing this at order 1 in omega, I just need to compute M3 at order 1 in omega, because when omega is 0, this is 0, but M2 is non-zero, it's the variance. So when I want the result here at order 1, I just need the order 1 here, and I'll be happy with the order 0 here. So let's do it. So we just need to take this to the cube and take the term that's linear in omega. Linear in omega is linear in delta xi. So you see that it will be 3 times this squared. Okay. So it's up there. And now, just now, I'm going to use the specification I use with the lambdas, the volatility of volatility, etc. But it's just an intermediary expression. What I get is that M3 has exactly this expression here, which is the double integral of the expectation of what I call the spot variance covariance function. So maybe I'll abbreviate that and I'll just say spot vol correlation or spot vol covariance or spot variance whatever, which is just the expectation of a move of the spot process at times tau times the variation at times tau of the expectation of a forward variance for a later time t. And I'm not going to spend time, but actually we could have written this result right away without doing the calculation. But anyway. So the basic ingredient that is going to enter the expression for the skew is this covariance function. So here I divide by d tau, because this is about d tau, and so I get this function of tau and t. So you see that here it's d psi t tau, so tau is smaller than t. You can even replace this tau by t and have the instantaneous variance, because since this psi is a martingale, the value at tau is the expectation of the value at time t. But anyway, so once then we divide by the M2 to the 3/2, we get the skewness, a dimensionless number. Then we divide by 6 square root of t, we get this expression. Okay. So we're going to use this expression later. That's for the skew. Now, before we use it, this is at order 1 in omega in the volatility of volatility. How accurate is it? Can we really use it? So here I'm giving an example here of the skew for different maturities. So these are maturities. here it goes up to 2 years. And the skew, when I plot the skew, I'm not using d sigma over d log k, but that same thing times minus 10. So in effect, it's the difference in points of volatility between the 95 strike and the 105 strikes. So on the graph, you have two curves. One is generated by a model that I will show later, and the other one is using this same expression, using this function f that comes out of the same model. And for reasonable ranges of parameters, the agreement is pretty satisfactory. It's not precise enough for pricing, but it's good enough that we can use it to say qualitative things about the model. Okay, so now that we have the handle on the what we will take as the static feature of the model, the skew, and especially the way it depends on maturity, that's what we're looking at. Let's look at the dynamic at the dynamics of the model and how we're characterizing it. So obviously the dynamics that the stochastic volatility model generates is very complex, because it's the joint motion of the underlying spot with all of the implied volatility. So that's a very something that's difficult to characterize. So let's just stick to something simple, and let's just ask the very simple question: how much does the at-the-money forward volatility move when the spot moves? So what I call the at-the-money forward volatility is the implied volatility for a strike that's equal to the forward. So if you want to just call that at-the-money volatility. So how much does it move? But in which units? What's the right normalization? Well, if the skew is steep, you can expect maybe the volatility, the at-the-money volatility, to move a lot when the spot moves. Suddenly, if it's flat, if it's Black-Scholes, you're not expecting it to move at all. So so a natural normalization is the skew, is the at-the-money skew. And this is actually what the kind of way of thinking that market makers have on index options, because what they do is that they are risk managing a book of very simple options, vanilla options, but instead they are not doing the Black-Scholes delta. They compute the delta and then they adjust it. They adjust it because they've noticed that there's a correlation between the moves of implied volatilities and the move of the underlying spot, and so they adjust the delta to account for that. And so they use the following ratio there, which is delta sigma over delta log s. So the sigma is just the at-the-money volatility, so how much it moves when the spot moves, divided by the skew, in units of the skew. So that's a dimensionless number. And typically they like to refer to two regimes, none of which occurs actually in practice, but anyway, it's like so one is when this ratio is equal to one, and they call it the sticky strike regime. So why is it natural from their point of view to refer to that kind of regime? So imagine you have, this is your smile, that's the spot today, and this is the at-the-money volatility, or at-the-money forward. And so R equals 1 means that, so you have a slope here, the skew slope. So R equals 1 means that when the spot moves, let's say it goes here, the at-the-money volatility has changed exactly by 1 times the slope of the smile, so it's here. So imagine that the smile had no curvature, that it was exactly like this straight line. It would mean that the implied volatilities for given strikes, set strikes, would not be moving at all in the model. So that means that in that case, the Black-Scholes delta is the right delta. So that's what the sticky strike regime means. And then they like to refer to another regime, which has R equals 0, which is a sticky delta regime, which just means that if the spot goes here, well, the R equals 0, so the at-the-money volatility has not varied at all. And so the new smile when I'm sitting here is this one. Anyway. Now, in this expression here, this delta sigma over delta log s is not a well-defined quantity, because only in local volatility models are implied volatilities functions of the spot. Usually they are not functions. They may be correct, they are not functions. So we're just taking a slight generalization of that ratio, which is here, which is just the regression of delta sigma over delta log S. So here you have the covariance of a move of sigma and move of S, and here the variance of S. So that's something that's now well defined in all models. And so I call that the skew stickiness ratio, and that's a dimensionless number. Now, there are a number of models for which we know what the value of the skew stickiness ratio is. For example, in pure jump or Levy models, you have exactly this property here that the smile experiences a translation alongside with the spot, and so you have R equals zero. Now, in the local volatility model for weak skew, you can show that R equals two. So it's an expansion in powers of the skew. And also in stochastic volatility models for short maturities and weak skew, you also get this value that R equals two. So let's just compute it again at order one in omega. So what we need to compute here is the covariance between log S and the variation of the eudaimonic volatility or eudaimonic forward volatility. Now, eudaimonic forward volatility is a very hard object to approximate typically in models. It's something that's very hard to get with sufficient accuracy. Turns out that since we're working at order one in omega, we don't even need to bother with it, because when you have no volatility of volatility, you're in the Black-Scholes framework, then the smile is flat and all volatilities collapse. So for example, the eudaimonic volatility is equal to the variance of volatility. Now, as soon as I turn omega on, there starts being a separation between the eudaimonic volatility and the variance of volatility. So eudaimonic vol is variance of vol plus omega times something. And then when I look at the variation of that thing, that gets multiplied by omega, so the difference becomes of order 2 in omega. So for the sake of computing this ratio at order 1 in omega, I'll be happy with just using the variance of volatility for sigma. So this is what I'm doing here, and because sigma squared is the integral of the variances xi, I get this expression here for this covariance, and I compute it, and I get exactly now a simple integral instead of a double integral, but of the same function f as before. So let me show again the definition of that function. This thing is so f of tau and t measures how much a move of the spot at time tau is correlated with the move of a forward variance at a later time t. So for the skew stickiness ratio, I'm just using that function with the first argument zero, because I'm moving the spot just right now. Okay, so now we have the skew stickiness ratio. We have the covariance divided by the variance, and we need to divide by the skew, which is here. So that we calculated before, and so we get this expression here. That was the expression for the skew before, and this is the expression for the skew stickiness ratio, and you see that this double integral, which was in the numerator, now goes into the denominator. Now, R is a dimensionless number, and S is a skew, so the dimension is volatility, so 1 over square root of time. So that's all we're going to use, actually, in the rest of the presentation, and we're going to see what these expressions imply. So this is a characterization of the static feature of the model, the skew as a function of maturity. This is something dynamic, how the eudaimonic vol moves when the spot moves in units of the skew. So let's first take the short maturity limit. Okay, so when we take the short maturity limit, so capital T tends to zero, small t tends to zero, so this stuff here tends to one, and then here all the arguments in F will tend to zero. I assume that F is regular, has no singularity, so F goes out. In the numerator, I get capital T times integral of zero, capital T dt, so that's T squared, and in the denominator, integral to T d tau, that's T dt, T squared over two. T squared over T squared over 2 is 2. So I get back this result that the skew stickiness ratio for stochastic volatility models is 2 for short maturities. Then if I look at the skew for very short maturities, as I take the limit T tending to 0, I see that there's no explosion or no vanishing of the skew. It tends to a finite constant, which just measures this spot vol covariance function at the origin. So now let's look. So this result that R equals 2 for stochastic volatility models for short maturities is known. And the fact that the skew actually also tends to a finite limit and is not exploding or going to zero is known too. So let's see what we can say for longer maturities. Now, for longer maturities, we're going to make a few more assumptions. One assumption we're going to make is that the variance curve, the initial variance curve, psi sub zero, is flat. Why? Because I don't want this to be polluted by this prefactor. This prefactor doesn't depend on the model at all. It's just a reflection of the shape of the initial variance curve. So I don't want that. If psi is constant, this will be, psi zero is constant, this will be one. I'm going to make that assumption. And I'm going to make another assumption, which is also very natural, which is that I have time homogeneity in the model. So in this constant, I mean, it means that this function f, this spot vol covariance function, will be actually a function of t minus tau and not a function of these two arguments separately. So when I do that, when I write that f is actually a function of t minus tau, I can actually do one of these integrals, and I get this new expression for the skew stickiness ratio. I had a double integral, now I have only one. This is the skew. This has not really changed. Okay, so let's. So what can we say once we have these expressions? Well, actually, we can say a few things. Let's look. So let's make one more assumption, which is that this function f, this spot vol covariance function, decays monotonically. So it can. So it can either be like that or like that. On equity markets, it's more like that. It's negative and it tends to zero for long time separation. It could be also that this way. Just because R has F both in the numerator and the denominator, it doesn't really matter the sign of F, so let's just assume it's positive decreasing. So now we can rewrite R by introducing G, which is just the integral of F from 0 to T. Once we do that, we have this expression here, which is just G evaluated at capital T divided by the average value of G over the interval 0 to capital T. So one thing we see right away is that because if F is positive, so F is positive, decreasing, so that's F. So when I look at G, G starts from 0 and it will be increasing, positive increasing. So then the final value divided by average value is always larger than 1. So I get the result that the skew stickiness ratio is larger than 1. Now G is increasing, but it's also concave because F is decreasing. So G is always higher than the chord. And by using that and sticking it here, I can also show then that I get another bound, which is 2. So we get this model independent result, given our assumptions, that R is restricted to the interval 1 to 2, the skew stickiness ratio. So that's one nice result to have, but can we say more than that? Well, if we want to say more than that, we have to make more assumptions. So let's try to see if we can make assumptions that are natural. So we have to assume now something about how fast F decays to zero. So certainly from a physicist's point of view, it's very natural to assume that F decays like a power law. So let's just assume that F decays like a power law with an exponent gamma, which measures the speed with which f goes to zero. So f, again, is this covariance function that measures how much a spot move is correlated to the move of a forward variance at a later time. So when you make this assumption, you can compute the integrals, and you will see that depending on the size of gamma, these integrals are either dominated by the part near zero or by their tails when t tends to infinity. They either converge or diverge. And this is what you get. So if gamma is larger than 1, so if they decay fast, let's say, then you get this universal behavior that the skew will decay like 1 over maturity, and the long time limit of the skew stickiness ratio is 1. Now this is very interesting because in the context of models with independent increments, like pure Levy or pure jump models, if the size of the jumps is not too large, you also have this property that the skew will decay like 1 over t, but you, in those models, you also get that the skew stickiness ratio is 0. So in stochastic volatility models, instead, you get this 1 over t behavior, but the skew stickiness ratio is tends to 1. So no matter what gamma is, if gamma is very large, you may reach this asymptotic regime fast, otherwise you'll reach it later, but this is what you get in the long maturity limit. If instead gamma is smaller than 1, you get a much, much more interesting behavior, because both in S and the skew, the way the skew depends on maturity and the skew stickiness ratio, you get a signature of the decay of the spot covariance function. You get the gamma that enters here. So basically the skew will decay like 1 over t to the gamma, and the skew stickiness ratio will be 2 minus gamma. So that's interesting. Why? Because when you look at real markets and you look at how the skew decays with maturity, the skew decays doesn't decay as fast as 1 over t. 1 over t is a very fast decay. In equity markets, you get a decay that's more or less like 1 over square root of t. So what stochastic volatility models do is that they tie these two properties together. If this is not like 1 over t, well, this is going to some non-trivial value, which is 2 minus gamma. Now, if you do the calculation assuming that f decays exponentially, which is faster than any parallel decay, as you expect, you get the type 1. So, and you can see that the two regimes, the two types of models, match each other as gamma crosses the value of 1. So this gives you a classification of stochastic volatility models into two types of models. Now, these can be condensed into this very compact formula, which says that for long maturities at order 1 in the volatility of volatility, in time homogeneous stochastic volatility models, you get that the skew will decay like 1 over t to the power of 2 minus the long maturity limit of the skew stickiness ratio. So that supplies the connection between, on one hand, the static picture of the model and the dynamic picture of the model. Now, once we have that, it is natural to ask two questions, actually. One question is it even possible to build a model that's of type 2? Because that's the interesting type. And the other question is, if I look at the real options markets, do they even conform to either one of these two types? Or are they yet another beast? So let's first answer the first question. So let's start with a very simple type of model, which is the kind of models I like to use. Well, the dynamics of the forward variances is given by this equation there. So there I have a some number of Brownian motions. Usually I use 2, but it could be any number of Brownian motions, W. There's this omega always sitting in front of the right-hand expression. The W are positive weights. And I have this Ki, which are the mean reversion constants in the model. What you see is that because I have exponentials of t minus t, these actually volatility functions are separable. So I have a dynamics for the whole curve, which is Markovian, which is just a function of a small number of factors. I do not need to carry the whole curve along as I simulate it. So that's actually a Markov functional model. So in a model like that, you can compute f, and it's very simple. It's just a superposition of exponentials. And once you stick this expression in the two expressions for f and s, you get the explicit expressions for the skew as a function of maturity and the skew stickiness ratio. Now, because f is a superposition of exponentials, obviously, if I go to really long times, it's going to be dominated by the exponential that decays the least, the slowest, but that's still an exponential decay. So for really long maturities, we will get type 1 behavior, which is 1 over t for the skew, and skew stickiness ratio tending to 1. So it does look like there's not much hope of getting type 2 behavior. But actually, we can, if we look at a smaller range of maturity. So this is for f really large, so t really large, so t going to infinity, but how large is large? So here I'm listing some parameters I use that are typical actually of index q's. So these are the two curves I showed you before. So this formula here versus the real skew computed by Monte Carlo simulation in this model. And here on the right, it's exactly the same curve, the same purple curve approximate, but in log-log plot. So this is maturity up to 2 years. This is skew. And you see that with these parameters, I have a power law decay. In log-log plot, it decays linearly, and you can even eyeball the slope. From here to here, I have basically two notches, and here one, so the slope is about minus 1/2. And this is typical of equity markets. The skew decays more like 1/√T. So, okay? So now let's compute the skew stickiness ratio. This thing here, with the same parameter. We know it has to start from value of 2 for short maturities, which it does, so that's 2, this is 1 here. And this is maturity, so 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years. 10 years is a very long maturity. For equities, 5 years is already a long maturity. So what you see is that it starts from 2. Eventually, we know that for really long maturities, it will tend to the value of 1. But look at that. Starts from 2, but then right away it stabilizes to a plateau, more or less, before it starts going towards 1. And the plateau is about around 1.5. And what is 1.5? It's 2 − 1/2. So 2 minus the power of this thing. So even though we are not getting type 2 behavior for ultra-long maturities, which we don't really care about, we are getting type 2 behavior of a range of maturities that's enough for practical purposes. So let's end this talk by looking at what happens in reality. So in reality, we have, if we look at the static smiles, we see that the skews decay more or less like 1/√ t. So that would suggest that the Eurostock smiles behave like type 2. That's the static picture, but if we look dynamically at the skew stickiness ratio, what do we find? So here I've taken data, implied vol data for 3 maturities, so 1 month, 6 months, 2 years, and I've computed the realized skew stickiness ratio. So it's just the covariance of moves of the volatility and implied volatility, moves of the spot, divided by variance of the spot times the skew. And I'm using a 3-month running estimate for those two sums. So the scale is 0 here, 1 here, and 2 up there. So what we see is, let's say we look at the curve for the 2-year maturity, so the purple curve. You see that it's, first of all, it stays between 1 and 2. And then if we look at the purple curve, it's pretty noisy, but if we were to draw an average value out of that curve, it would be around 1.4, 1.6. Which is 2 minus more or less 1/2. I mean, they don't decay exactly like 1/√. Sometimes it's a part that's 0.4, 0.35. Yeah. So they seem to be, for long maturities, the prediction seems to be satisfied. If I look at long maturity smiles, at least the Eurostock's implied volatility seem to behave like a type 2 stochastic volatility model. Now, there's one thing left that's puzzling, though, is that if I look at the 1-month maturity, a data for 1-month maturity, which is considered small on equities, we had the prediction that we should get a number of 2. We're not getting 2. We're getting always lower, sometimes much lower than 2. And so here there's a question here. It's got to be one thing or the other. So either we can arbitrage that, so either we can set up a trading strategy that will materialize as a P&L, i.e. monetize the difference between 2 and the realized skew stickiness ratio, or if we are unable to do that, then it means we're completely wrong. So that would mean what? To be wrong? Imagine, for example, that the real market, the real Euro stocks market, behaves like a junk model. So Euro stocks behaves like a junk model, and its associated implied volatilities behave also according to the same model. Then we know in junk models we have to get zero as realized skew stickiness ratio. Here we think that we should get two, and we're going to try to arbitrage that. As we do that, we'll see that we're not going to be able to extract any P&L from a trading strategy. So we have to do that to see if that's possible. I'm not going, that's in the paper, I'm not going to go through that because that would require, again, 45 minutes, but turns out it's approximately possible to materialize that as a P&L. So that also says, that also tells us that we can actually introduce the notion of realized skew, just as it is possible to introduce the notion of realized skew stickiness ratio, we can introduce the notion of realized skew, and that's what we are arbitraging against the market skew, and that's what's written up there, where sigma zero is the at-the-money volatility. And here I'm just showing you two curves, I'm not going to comment them, but two curves which show one, the market skew, and the other one, the realized skew, which show more or less the same pattern as the skew stickiness ratios for the US stocks. But anyway, so let me get to the end of my presentation now, conclusion. So what we show is that in stochastic volatility models, at order one in the volatility of volatility, there's the connection between the skew stickiness ratio and the rate at which the at-the-money forward skew decays. They are related to that object F, the spot vol covariance function, or spot variance covariance function. For time homogeneous models and flat time structures, we get bounds, lower bound and higher bound for the skew stickiness ratio, 1 and 2. For type 2 models, in both in the decay of the skew and the long maturity limit of the skew stickiness ratio, we get a signature of the power of the decay of the spot vol covariance function, and index volatility markets seem to be consistent with type 2. Now, for short maturity SMILES, we get that it has to be equal to 2, this ratio R, and we're able to introduce the notion of realized skew. Now, what's interesting in the realized skew is that you see that there's no such thing as the realized volatility. What the realized skew involves is a covariance between spot move and implied volatility move. And it's exactly what generates the market skew. The market skew is not generated by the correlation between spot and realized volatility, it's generated by the correlation between spot and implied volatility. And something that I didn't show, but which I studied in the paper, is that the mismatch between 2 and the realized value of the skew stickiness ratio for short maturities can be approximately materialized as a P&L. So I guess that's the end of my presentation.